So everybody get to that little showcase selection page. So and also I just texted Maxie that link in case people aren't there. So now here we come to the second half of the presentation, which is where is digital space today? So you heard about my little personal odyssey and my intellectual odyssey, or oddity, Bruce's space oddity. And now, where do we end up? Well, we did all that experimentation in cyberspace, and by the way, a lot of this is not even written up. It happened so quickly, and there's so much that I wrote a book chapter on the Rusty Schweikart experience. But believe me, so much of this stuff is in the heads of various people, including yourselves. It really ought to be written up because it's important in the history of this medium that it does get written up clearly by the original people who experienced it. And I invite you all to do that. It needs to be documented. Otherwise, no one will remember or recall that this was done. Anyway, so if you look at the showcase selection page, that's what the kind of projects we've been doing in the last several years, since about, well, 1998, 99, 2000. And I'm just going to go look at that and decide what to talk about. Hold on. Well, they're pretty much all there. What we're not showing yet, because it's not a completed contract, is the work on modeling human return to the moon, which the president, for better or for worse, has decided to kickstart NASA. And of course, this was a decision that was necessitated by the loss of the Columbia, because it was really clear that NASA's culture was not reformed. Due to the fact that Columbia was lost for the same reasons, institutionally, the same reasons as the Challenger was lost, which was no one taking responsibility for a potentially serious problem that led to a hot gas intrusion of the vehicle, which is what happened with Challenger with the hot gas blow-by, and what happened with Columbia with the penetration of the carbon-carbon for leading edge wing tile area, which basically cut the left wing off. So it was in the loss of seven individuals at the both missions. So there's one on ascent, one on descent. So it's kind of a strange, weird, bizarre symmetry to all that. But it was clear that the shuttle was very expensive, and it was a system that either was very reliable, but subject to institutional failures, or just too big and complex, and something had to be done because there was only three shuttles left, and the space station was very complex. That, on the whole, you build a space station with 13 partners, and it seems like a good idea, but you end up with something that's so complex. You compare the International Space Station, which most people don't really know anything about. Actually, it's not really been publicized much. If they think that there's a space station, they're not sure if it's a big rotating wheel or not. And you compare that with Skylab, which was very simple. It was very spacious. It was the top third stage of a Saturn. It was a beautiful station. A friend of mine who's passed away now was involved in the rescue of Skylab in 73 when they lost a bunch of stuff on the way up. And of course, they let it deorbit. I mean, they did not, they lost it in 79 and re-entered the atmosphere. And if Skylab had, they had taken the effort to save Skylab by boosting it up, the shuttle would have docked with Skylab on the second or third mission. And we would have had a functioning, simple space station, which was simple enough that it allowed people to have free time. Can you imagine that? On board the space station, there's so much complexity and systems that are failing and have to be fixed and stuff all the time that it overwhelms the ability of human beings to deal with it. And it's the space station as it is now is an interesting test case in how not to make something. You make something that the only thing that you can do is keep it flying. And it sounds like computer networks, right? I mean, we make them and operating systems, and it takes all our time just to keep them running. But it's a little, it employs a lot of people, so maybe that's a good thing. So in NASA's future vision, which is being has been initiated by President's speech last January, they are reorganizing the place. They have basically created a new office, and they've thrown $1 billion into the air and said, everybody run for it. And so we all wrote grant proposals, and the dollars mostly fall outside of NASA civil servants. So it mostly falls to outside companies. And the whole thing is, come up with a vision for going back to the moon, for going to Mars, for getting something to replace the shuttle, something that's, that's simpler, that whole kind of thing. So since May, I've been writing proposals after proposals after proposals. And I wrote a huge proposal together with a guy named Jaron Lanier, who actually coined the term virtual reality in the 80s. He's a really amazing guy. He's like a great big guy with dreadlocked hair and a great musician and a genius, basically. And he lives in Berkeley. And we got together and we wrote this proposal, which was not funded, but was very interesting to write, to basically kind of build something like Traveler would fly on board a spaceship that would provide instant training for emergencies. And obviously the reviewers at NASA found fault with it, and we'll try again in a year or two. But the idea is embodied. If you look on the showcase page, you'll see one thing for astronaut training, where the astronauts are moving around in a space. Now, these are virtual astronauts. And I don't know if you can see that particular page. That page is called SIM-EVA. You can take a chance and try to start the atmosphere version of that. It may crash your system. it may work. You can also play the movie files associated with that. One of them's too big. It's like 256 megs. But there's other little movie files if you're at all interested, or just look at the pictures. And that is actually, and this is fascinating, what we do is something that is really unique for NASA. We go in this case, to the Neutral Buoyancy Laboratory at Johnson Space Center, which is a giant swimming pool. I mean, it's one of the world's biggest tanks of water. It's incredible. And the water is very, very pure. So pure that the whole pool becomes a battery when they put electric stuff in it. And it corrodes any metal that's in it because it's a battery, for goodness sakes. But inside that pool is a mock-up of the space station, kind of all twisted onto its side. And that's where they train astronauts to go outside, and they put them in spacesuits that are neutrally buoyant, that float, and they stick them underwater. They jump into the water. Divers are with them. And they make like they're outside in space and doing stuff. It's a beautiful facility. This kind of thing has been used since the 60s. Even the Soviets used this kind of technique. And so we went there, and they said, there's a gap in the training in that we can't simulate everything in space that we need to. We can't simulate when the sun goes up and down and the lighting. And a lot of things, like where the shuttle is, we can't do that. And there's a lot of things that are hard to explain to an astronaut who is trying to get ready to do a big spacewalk and do something really complex that lasts for 10 hours. And they've got all these parts and things, huge checklists of things. And sometimes we miss things. So we said, fine, what we'll do is we'll take video of the training in the tank and we'll remake a movie of it. In 3D Studio Max, so we make a feature film, just as though you were with the diver moving around. And then we do is when they look at that movie and they say, that is exactly what we do, because we've made the movie. We haven't used any motion capture where we have any little devices on the astronauts. haven't done any of that. We've just done it from eyeballing it. And Dave R. and Marin and the team in Australia and the kids, the young kids that they have hired are so good at spatial modeling, and you guys can relate, that they can actually look at video frame by frame and make the 3D models in the proper depth for the entire thing. And to the people, to the program planners and the facility managers at the Neutral Buoyancy Lab, it looks like they've captured the whole thing in 3D graphics. And so they're blown away. But it's just the skill, the spatial skill of these modelers. And so then what we do is break it up and make an actual walkable real-time 3D model in Adobe Atmosphere, or more recently in the Ogre 3D platform, which is open source completely, where you can then move yourself around, move your viewpoint, watch the astronauts taking the parts around, going up to repair something on the station, change the sequence of what they're doing, the order of what they're doing, all that sort of stuff, and change scenarios. And that will is a tool that allows an astronaut to say, okay, what if we stop here because the sun's coming up and we'll be blinded by the sunlight, and we do this other task and wait for our visors and our eyes to adjust. Then we go back in and we bolt down the blah, blah. And so quickly, and this is a tool that we're now contracted to build, we quickly pull in all the gestures and animations to show how that would work. And then the people click on the links and the plus and minus and start the simulation again virtually and say, okay, let's try that, let's try that, let's try that. And then after doing that in the virtual world, which is the cheapest, they go into the tank and they do it, which is more expensive to do. And then people who are in orbit, people who are on a space station or on a future mission to the moon, get beamed the training that was developed for the procedure to run on a laptop on board the vehicle in space and study it, go move their viewpoint around. It's like running traveler in space, and look up and down and say, well, gee, you know, these guys really have worked out what it's probably going to be like when we go outside the hatch and try to fix something. And thank you very much, because we can't return to Earth to do the training. And that's our vision for NASA. That's one of the parts of the vision of one of the set of clients for NASA, set of projects for NASA we're doing, is to deliver this and to run it on the space station or in future mission. Other projects, as you can see, we modeled the Mars rover. We modeled, we're now doing a future return to the moon. We're doing Mars habitat with Bill Clancy and the FMARS and the MDRS habitat in Utah, where we model life aboard that habitat, the Mobile Agents Project, and other things that aren't NASA, like the National Institutes of Health, video games for autistic children who can't make facial contact with you but will make facial contact with a little dog named Buddy and follow him around in a virtual world and cross the street safely. And that's a wonderful project. And we're building a site for that project. We just completed that work. And the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City, which is a big campus, teaching people about the apparel business and fashion design in the Garment District in Manhattan. We did something with a professor there called Ratava's Line, and Ratava's avatar spelled backwards. And Ratava's Line is, this is all on the showcase page, by the way. Ratava's Line is fashionable avatars. You know, what happens when you have an avatar that can wear a beautiful flowing garment? And it can become a mechanism for people to share designs. Oops, I'm getting bumped here somewhere. And we have a new guest here, Bob. Anyway, so the fashion design project was a tremendous success. It was presented to the press and everything. And so that's been another great and fun a fun project, a digital space. And it's going to move a bit. I just moved a bit forward here. Other thing I'd like to tell you guys about, and then I'll shut up and you can ask questions, is the way we reorganized the company. In about 2-3 years ago, and this is something I've been thinking about for about 10 years, I thought, it's kind of crazy when you form a company and you issue shares, you create stock. Then you say, I'm the founder, I'll have all the stock. And then you say, no, I need other people, a partner, I will split the stock. And then employees come in and they get some stock. And then investors come in and they say, well, issue more shares and dilute your position because the investor needs stock. And then you go onto the public market and anybody who had a little tiny chunk of stock suddenly has the stock they can sell. And it all sounds great. I mean, it sounds like it's a great party to be part of, except that often it doesn't work that way. Often the founders, visionary founders, are given the heave-ho by the investors and the money people that come in. And they sometimes are left with nothing. Stock is made non-voting and it's class, not class A, etc. And so you get nothing. Employees that work to build up the company often don't get anything. The people who really pull the hours. And in the end, it's a real battle. It's a real greed fest. Now, this isn't true for all companies. One company, Microsoft, has generally spread the wealth around. Other companies have not. But it seemed to me that since digital space, the idea of digital space is it's like a home. It's a place you can be in for your career. We've only been around 10 years, 10 years as of next August. But it's like a community. And so why should we have stock in the first place? Because then it creates a setup for people to compare how many shares they have versus somebody else. And I said, well, what's the purpose of the stock anyway? And I started reading about the history of shareholder companies. And I realized that they're pretty new invention. They're a newfangled thing. In fact, the original shareholder companies, like the original Hudson Bay Company or East India Company, they generally what they did is issued one share, or they basically issued a membership license to a member of their organization that said, you are a member, you have these rights and responsibilities. If you want assistance, you can go to any of the company posts, but you must give assistance to other members, and preferential treatment, etc. And I realized at that point, then I dug a little bit further back, and there were the idea of guilds and marketplace associations. And I realized that there were other ways to create a human economic structure. That, in fact, the shareholder company, especially in the case where the shares are bought and sold very rapidly by speculators on the market, was a newfangled thing. This is not a traditional business model. This was a experimental business model. And as the dot-com crash happened and the Enron stuff and whatever, I realized, wait a minute, this model may be a failed experiment if these companies are in the hands of or are victims of speculation. And then, of course, if you look at the whole world economy, if we privatize Social Security or something, we're putting even that into the potential reach of speculators. So what happened in the 80s with corporate buyouts and mergers and stuff like that was a lot of gutting of great companies that had been around for a century or something. And they were basically raided. Their good value was taken, used to borrow a leveraged buyout, and they were gutted. And then they got rid of the people who'd worked there for several generations and blah, blah, blah. And we all just sort of said, okay, well, that's the modern way. And I started thinking, is this a really good way to run an economy? Why is it that we have to put up with the gutting of institutions that have functioned for a long period of time? And why do we have to do that? And there's Howard Smith sitting right in front here, who's a great student and theorist and writer about organizations and how to affect better, better internal functioning of organizations. And one of the things, of course, you can't affect better internal functioning of organizations if the organization's constantly buffeted by the whims of speculative investment, of raiders, stuff like that. If it's being torn apart by those forces, you can't help a company that 2 years down the road is going to be merged in with another company with another culture, and basically all the people laid off. So I realized that digital space could set a kind of a weird example. it could say, look, we're not going to use the experimental speculative models of corporate that recently have been somewhat hijacked. We're going to use traditional business models, which means a membership structure. Now, these things exist. The huge Visa MasterCard system, it's all membership. All those banks, those thousands, tens of thousands of banks, are members of Visa. And it's just a regular corporation. It doesn't issue stock. So I read the history of Visa. I read the history of McDonald's. And I found out that the McDonald's system, in the beginning, the franchise owners, the people who owned the stores, were members. And they had rights and responsibilities. They could invent the Big Mac, and the system would give them more licenses to open more stores. They had to share their inventions with everybody. And this idea of membership organizations was incredibly that it exists today. So Digital Space was reorganized, and we call ourselves the Digital Space Commons, because the word commons kind of implies a plaza and a membership, kind of a structure, a commons, a commonly held thing. We redid our logo, which many of you have so kindly modeled here in Traveler, to look like an open sort of five-pointed entry to a medieval marketplace. And it's where it's open to the world, but there is a core of it. And you can see I drew that out one day, and Maren Nielsen made the graphics, which are now spread all over the place. But that's the new logo. We're still Digital Space Corporation to the outside world, and we do contracts, but we have a membership structure internally, the Digital Space Commons. So then our website's called the Digital Space Commons. And as a result, for the last 2-3 years, you know, basically what it's come down to is any member has the right to go after business or innovate or do what they want, as long as they stay within the guidelines of the commons. They don't actually have to get my approval. They have the right to self-organize and do stuff. And that's what's happened. You know, we've got 15, 16 people in the group now, and they do their own thing. They do a lot of volunteer projects for each other to establish a social capital. And here comes another guest. That's how we reorganized. And in some sense, all of you out there in Traveler are kind of extended members, because you exist in a space that kind of got glued on to Digital Space. And you know, you're very welcome. And if you, to get into Digital Space as a member, you go through almost something like the Rotary Club or the a medieval guild would have, like it's like an apprenticeship. So there's a process by which you're nominated to become a member, and you complete a project with other members, and et cetera, et cetera. Oh, Howard just got plastered. Hello. Please be polite. Anyway, I think that is probably enough time. I've been speaking for about an hour. It's hard to believe, or maybe not so hard for me. And why don't we just open it up and see if people have some questions about all this.